time once again for Community Forum, and we're very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning Dr. Jonathan Balcom. Dr. Jonathan Balcom is a research scientist with the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. He has contributed to more than 30 academic journals and book chapters, including Animal Behavior, The American Biology Teacher, the Journal of Applied Animal Welfare Science, Contemporary Topics in Laboratory Animal Science, and the British Medical Journal. His books include The Use of Animals in Higher Education, Problems, Alternatives, and Recommendations, Pleasurable Kingdom, Animals and the Nature of Feeling Good, and he is here to talk about his new book, Second Nature, The Inner Lives of Animals. Dr. Balcom, thank you very much for coming in and spending time with us this morning.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
Start out, and before we get into your book, maybe if you could just briefly tell us about the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine.
Sure. PCRM is a nonprofit organization based in Washington, D.C., founded in 1984, that focuses on better health through prevention, in particular with a focus on plant-based diets. They also work for higher standards in research, testing, and education, and that means specifically working to replace the harmful use of animals in those endeavors.
All right. So tell us, what was the motivation in writing your new book, Second Nature?
Two things, really. One is there is a lot of exciting science coming out about animal behavior, animal sentience. What are animals thinking and feeling? These were questions that weren't being asked by scientists through much of the 20th century. And in the last 30, 40 years, there's been a burgeoning of interest in that area. There's even a journal now on animal cognition focused on animal minds. But a lot of this information gets buried away in the scholarly journals, the peer-reviewed literature, and the public, many of whom are hungering for this information, doesn't have easy access to it. So a big part of the reason for writing this book is to make this information accessible to the public. Second reason is our troubled relationship with animals. We kill more animals per year now than at any other time in history, mainly to eat them. About 98 of every 100 animals is killed to be eaten, and we're talking close to 100 billion animals a year worldwide. So it's a big problem, and there's a lot of suffering involved in that. And it links to global warming as well and human health issues. So a huge issue there, and I think that a lot of people are swayed when they learn that animals actually have rich inner lives, that they're aware that they have lives that matter to them. So by bringing that information to light, I'm hoping that people will move towards a better relationship to other animals.
Do you have a sense for why there is more research going on with what's happening with animals now?
I guess it's a sort of a philosophical change in the way science works. Science goes through phases of, all human culture goes through phases, different phases. In the case of science, there was just a period through the 20th century where it was thought that because animals' experiences were private, then there was no point in asking questions about them and trying to understand them. So it was sort of a form of terminal agnosticism, as one scientist has called it. And then in the late 20th century, that kind of broke down, and we have a new era now where it's not taboo anymore, and it's a legitimate stuff, and you can ask questions about what animals think and feel, and you can devise very clever experiments to show that animals actually have, emotional changes to things, and that they're thinking about things. They have good memories, and that they have culture and even virtue. And we can talk about those things.
All right, good. I hope you bring up some examples of that. So you have the envious job of going through and seeing the latest cutting edge research on this. Maybe you can give us some examples of some of the unique capabilities that animals have that until, recently we didn't assume that they did.
Sure, and there are so many. Where to start? I mean, I could start with fishes. Fishes are not just, we say fish or fishes. I mean, there's 27,000 odd species of them, so they're a hugely diverse group, and they have different capabilities in their own right. But we've often dismissed them as kind of mindless, cold-blooded automatons that, because they don't scream and they're in pain, they don't have facial expressions that we recognize. We just assume they're kind of things, not much more than a block of wood. But actually, fishes have inner lives. They have complex social behavior in many cases. And so it's been really fun to delve into the literature and see what's going on in the fish world. There's a book called Fish, Cognition, and Behavior that was published about 4 years ago. And it's a scholarly volume, but but just the fact that there's a book devoted to that is impressive. I could just give one example of an interesting social behavior in fishes. There's these things called cleaning stations. They're typically on reefs, although some other habitats have them. And there's certain fishes, like the cleaner wrasse, who have a sort of a cleaning service that they offer to other fishes. And it's sort of like a barbershop, you know, opening up for business. And the wrasse swims in a certain way to signal his or her readiness to service other fishes. And other fishes will actually line up to wait their turn to be given this sort of spa treatment, where the cleaner fish kind of plucks over their skin, removes sloughing skin and ectoparasites and things like that. So the cleaner fish benefits by getting some nutrition, and the clients benefit by getting sort of this spa treatment. And there's every indication that the clients enjoy this treatment. And this sort of behavior is known from other groups too. Hippos are also cleaned by fishes, and they seem to enjoy that. And there's even a case where warthogs in parts of Africa will lie down, and these mongooses will clamber over them and pluck away at their skin and nibble away, and I guess they're getting little tidbits and that they like. And the warthogs, as far as we can tell, they're just absolutely loving this. I have a photo of that. Yeah. So that's an interesting behavior. In the case of the fishes, though, it gets Machiavellian, because sometimes the cleaner fish will take a little nip. It's sort of a cheating behavior. And then quickly swim away, knowing he or she's done a bad thing. And the client, if it's a new client, will often chase that fish. If they're a long-established relationship, that probably won't happen anyway, because you don't want to cheat on a good, valued business partner. And other fishes observe these interactions. They actually form image scores. That's the scientist's term, image scores for how these cleaners do their job. And if they're inclined to nip, then they won't get many clients. So it's pretty complicated and surprising for a fish, for an animal we didn't think was aware and had things going on. There's things like culture, orcas, these are killer whales. There's seals off the coast here and further north who live among orcas year-round, resident orcas. And those orcas have a particular dialect, and the seals recognize that dialect, and they're comfortable with that when they hear those orcas calling, because they don't attack seals. But there's migratory ones that come through twice a year that do pursue and attack seals, and they have a different dialect. And the seals have learned to translate the dialects, and they recognize that dialect. And when they hear that, they head for the hills, or more like they head for the kelp beds and the coast to avoid them. So that's an interesting case of culture in one species and another species interpreting the different language and acting accordingly.
Well, talk more about that, the whole concept of language and vocabulary. That seems that would be something unique just to humans.
That's right. We've sort of been language supremacists, and we've sort of thought we were the only ones with language. And we have a very special language. We have a great language, and we can do wonderful things with our language. But we have to realize other animals are good at what's useful to them. They live in their own worlds. They have their own sensory abilities. And they have ways of communicating that are meaningful to them and that are useful to them. It's not very useful for prairie dogs to talk about different computer platforms, but it's very useful for prairie dogs to have terms for different types of predators, because unfortunately for prairie dogs, they have a lot of enemies out there in the prairies where they live. And they have a special call for an eagle or a hawk, an aerial predator that's very dangerous. The proper response to that call is to head for the nearest burrow and head down the burrow and don't stay at the entrance. If it's a coyote call, then they head to the burrow and just remain vigilant at the entrance. If it's a domestic dog that someone spotted and they make this particular alarm call for a domestic dog, the proper response is just to stay alert where you are, unless the dog's right near you, and then you want to run to the burrow. If it's a human, you pretty much want to get out of the way, and they quickly modify different calls for shapes, sizes, colors. One study showed that a human carrying a gun, if a human discharges a gun into the ground 5 days in a row in the colony, the prairie dog colony, the prairie dogs will quickly begin to modify the call to indicate that it's a human carrying a gun, and they will respond differently to that sound. And when you consider that these populations of these animals have declined 98% since before Europeans came on the scene, largely through habitat loss and persecution with guns, perhaps it's not surprising that they modify their calls for a human carrying a gun.
Are there any other animals that have vocabulary specific to identify humans?
Probably. I believe vervet monkeys do. And these are just animals that have been studied closely. I mean, most animals don't get studied closely in the wild. But when we do study an animal in the wild, we discover, or in captivity, but wild I think is a purer way to study them. We discover things about them we just didn't realize before. So there's so much going on there, and even animals who've been well studied, there's probably a lot more going on below the surface, so to speak, that we're just not party to. And it's only when we get up close and personal and study them, and particularly long-term studies are useful, like Jane Goodall type studies where it's over decades, and in particularly long-term, long-lived animals such as elephants, baboons, and things like that. There's some really interesting discoveries about them because you get to know who's related to who and how they respond differently to those relatives.
And with a lot of those studies, do they have a specific goal when they're going in to look at those behaviors, or is it just something they discover in kind of an overall observing this over time?
It's a good question. It's really a combination of the two, because by living up close to animals, you make happenstance observations, and those observations, those original anecdotes, generate questions. So, for instance, when baboon mothers have been observed who've lost an infant, their behavior changed. And so the scientists were intrigued by that. So let's study this more closely. Let's start collecting their poop and analyzing it for hormones, which we can now do. We no longer have to catch them and dart them and draw blood, which is very stressful, which affects hormone levels. So now we can collect, scientists can collect feces from these animals. And lo and behold, when a mother baboon loses an infant, her glucocorticoid hormone levels in her bloodstream go up in a pronounced way for a month or more. And this actually echoes the physiological response of a woman who loses a child as well. Our hormones go up, and theirs do in a very similar way. And then in behaviorally, they also respond similarly to women who've lost an infant. We rally around. We offer moral support, sort of a social network. We deliver flowers. I don't think baboons deliver flowers as far as is known, but they do expand their social networks. They groom more. They receive more grooming from other baboons. And it's thought to be a form of therapy that helps them to recover from this bereavement. And bereavement is the term the scientists use. All indications are that these animals are feeling grief at the loss. Incidentally, just recently there was a new study on chimpanzees, mothers who'd lost infants, and they will often carry their infant around for days, even weeks. One mother carried her infant around for 68 days following death. So if that isn't an indication of some level of emotional attachment to that infant, I don't know what is.
And I don't know if are baboons used in research here in the U.S.?
They are indeed. I'm currently actually looking at some records of baboons from a lab. These animals are often wild-caught. They may be captive-born. To me, it doesn't really make much difference. And then they are used for things like H1N1 viral research, hepatitis research, various forms of research that are intrinsically harmful to those individuals. And beyond the actual experimental paradigm itself, there's the issue of the daily grind of living in a lab. The animals are often singly housed. Some labs are better than others about trying to give them social housing, but they're caged. They're in confined circumstances, usually indoors, and they're subjected regularly to unpleasant procedures, handling and restraint, injections, blood collection, sometimes 100 or more of those during their years in the lab. And very few of them make it out of the lab. There are a few sanctuaries now for animals to retire to, but the great majority, probably well over 99% of animals in labs, monkeys included, but certainly rats and mice, end up being killed either in the research or at the termination of the study.
And in addition to suffering that themselves, do they suffer when they perceive their others in their group enduring these things?
That's an insightful question, because there actually has been some investigation into this, what's called witnessing effects. And I was actually looking at the literature some years ago for a review paper on how routine laboratory procedures can cause stress in animals. And one of the things that's being tested by scientists is, how does it affect a rat or a mouse if another rat or a mouse is being killed in the same room or caused pain? And these things can be measured, and indeed the stress hormone levels in these witnessing animals go up when that happens. An interesting study, not a very nice study, I'm glad I wasn't a mouse in this study, but mice who are writhing in pain from injections into the stomach or the feet If there's another mouse in the cage next door who can witness them through a barrier, a pane of glass, on witnessing this mouse writhing, will themselves become much more sensitive to pain. But there's two provisos. One is only females, not males. And two is it's only if they know that other mouse. So it's sort of a socially mediated thing. It's not just a sort of a stimulus response thing, which we so often simplify animals to doing, just stimulus response. No, the mouse is aware of who specifically that is who's writhing on the other side of that barrier. And if they know that mouse, a sibling or perhaps a cage mate, they will show a heightened pain response themselves.
So one would expect, I think, in the non-human primates, because they are supposedly so close to humans, a lot of human traits and characteristics. But I think it's it would be surprising to a lot of people that mice and or rats would be going through these traumas. And I remember last time we interviewed you about your previous book, Pleasurable Kingdom, you had talked, I think it was about rats and laughter. Can you briefly touch on that?
Sure. There's an American neuroscientist named Jaak Panksepp, and he's done some very interesting investigations into this sort of a mirthful response in rats. Young rats play a lot, and one of their common play behaviors is to flip each other onto their backs and then kind of tickle each other in the belly. And it turns out rats love this. And so what Jaak and his colleagues did was they took a group of rats and they divided them into two groups, and then they each rat was I'm going to make this simpler or much shorter than that long explanation. Let me put it this way. Rats who have been trained to expect to be petted on the neck, just a hand gently stroking them on the back, they will come to the hand. They like that. But rats who have trained to be expecting, when they go into this arena, to expecting to be flipped on their back and tickled in the belly as they do when they play with each other, they will run to the hand on average four times as quickly. And scientists like to measure things because that gives you a quantitative comparison. So they like both, but they absolutely love to be tickled in the belly. And then by recording their sounds, and these are ultrasonic sounds, we can't hear them, which is an important point. A lot of this stuff goes on outside our sensory bandwidth, and we need to use special equipment or use videotape and slow it down to see some subtleties and nuances that are going on that we may not have noticed before. So in this case, when you monitor their calls, these ultrasonic calls, it shows that they're making these really high-pitched chirping sounds. Those are indicative of the areas of the brain that are active during these behaviors are the same areas that are active when we're laughing at a joke or we're sort of feeling mirthful or being tickled. So there's both behavioral and physiological parallels. Again, sort of like the baboon's bereavement, in case of rat mirth, there's good rigorous science supporting the fact that they're experiencing a similar sort of affect, a similar kind of emotional, physical response to being tickled that we would have when we're tickled.
So, and do you think this also applies to mice? Are they that close, in the animal hierarchy? And also, if they have laughter at a frequency we cannot hear, could they also be suffering or, pain and or doing, screaming at a level that we couldn't hear?
That's part of the problem, is we're not tuned into their bandwidth, as I say. And for a long time, no one was asking questions about how the equipment in labs might be affecting these animals who have sensory hearing at high pitches. And a lot of the computers and the lights that we use, someone finally set up the equipment to show that these things are sometimes putting out some pretty high decibel sounds. It's just that we don't hear it, but they do. And so that is a major welfare concern. And your question about how mice compare to rats, they're radically different. They look very similar superficially, and they're related as small rodents, but they have different forms of social life, somewhat different ways of communicating. But there are also some very strong parallels as well. And as I just mentioned, the empathy study in mice, and by the way, that's that study where a mouse was writhing and another animal became more sensitive to pain, the conclusion was a sort of a form of empathy is what these mice were showing. So empathy is not an emotion we would have applied to mice a while ago, and now that's beginning to happen. We're realizing these animals have much more complex lives. Mice are highly perceptive of what they do. They also have ultrasonic calls. They It's a social courtesy to leave a little dribble of urine when you're moving around. It would be considered rude in our society, but in mice, it's a normal behavior. And other mice are able to divine a lot of information from that urine. They can tell male or female, of course, but they can also tell, estimate how old that other mouse was. They, of course, will recognize individuals that way, so it may be someone they know, and they're cooler with that. But if it's someone they don't know, if it's a male mouse, they may be uptight about that. They can even detect parasite loads from the urine that another mouse leads. So sometimes the other mouse leaving the urine trail is leaving information perhaps that they would rather not leave, but there it is. It's available.
All right. Talk a bit about, if you could, the different animals that we consume on a daily basis as part of our food. So I'm thinking like the traditional farm animals, chickens, pigs, cows. Can you tell us anything about them?
Sure can. They've been well studied. There's a lot of them out there, and we have this common assumption that animals in captivity or animals raised for food are somehow dimmer or duller, and that's just not true. I think maybe it makes us feel more comfortable about putting them on our plates if we can reduce them somehow. But they're as sentient and aware as the next animal. Studies with chickens show that they also have an alarm calling system. They have separate different calls for large, medium, and small aerial predator, and they respond appropriately to these sounds. They have, a rooster has a come-hither call for hens if he finds some food, and he, it's sort of a social favor. He'll call her over, she'll come over, and he'll let her have the food. It's very gallant, and of course, if you're cynical enough, you'll realize he's probably buying some credit for to be traded in at a future time, so that requires individual recognition and memory and monitoring of others like those fishes do. Sometimes they will cheat. Roosters will make a call when there's no food there. They only will do it if a hen's far enough away that she's not likely to detect the ruse. She comes running, and he does the usual thing, and, well, maybe the grasshopper jumped away. So, but hens are perceptive. They will recognize an inveterate cheater, so it doesn't pay to cheat too often in nature. Pigs have been shown to very quickly learn how a mirror functions in a recent study. They understand the concept of a reflection in a mirror. Pigs have been known to pick up the collars of other pigs that allow them to access to food, and it gives them a double portion in the day. So, and pigs are widely known now to be very, very intelligent. And then studies of cows show that they have eureka moments when they solve a problem. That was a study that came out a couple of years ago. Sheep have superb face recognition skills. They can remember 50 or so of their original flock mates 2 years after they were taken out of their flock, just from single photographs, either straight on or profile. They also prefer the picture of a smiling human face over a frowning one, and they would rather go through a door that has a photo of a just fed and presumably contented sheep than a photo of a very hungry and presumably stressed sheep, even though they look similar to us. And that, to me, says a lot. It says that they have acute face recognition skills, but also they're reading the emotions of other sheep. And if they're reading the emotions of other sheep, well, the sheep are feeling emotions. This shouldn't surprise us, but again, science wasn't even asking questions about that, and it's so easy for us to dismiss these animals as simple and dim, and that's just not the case. They have, as I like to say, rich, complex inner lives, hence the title of my book, The Inner Lives of Animals.
So go back to the pigs and a mirror. Is that the concept, self-recognition? Is that?
It was just seeing how quickly they learned to grasp that if they see something that's actually in a mirror, that the object isn't just in line with what they're seeing. It's actually on the other side of a barrier. And then they can quickly learn to go around that barrier. They know that that's where it is. And so the study was just cleverly designed to show that they very quickly grasp that. And essentially, I think, one trial learning.
All right. And then, Cal, what is a eureka moment?
A eureka moment is kind of like when you celebrate a new discovery. In this case, they had to solve a problem. They had to find a button and push it to open a gate to access to food or outdoor pasture, things they like to do, to have access to. And cattle who had the door opened automatically without doing anything just kind of went through. But cattle who had caused it to open because of something they did, they actually found this button, they would kick up their legs, they just tossed their head, they showed behaviors that were indicative of a sort of a celebration, a feeling of surprise and excitement about solving a problem.
All right. Talk a bit about our common house pets, cats and dogs. Everybody assumes that anybody that has a pet is sure that their pet has these unique qualities that
sure.
nobody else's does.
Yeah, when I give talks about animals, I ask the audience, put your hand up if you think that cats and dogs are not emotional, and very rarely does any hand go up. If you've lived with them, you know that they have complex inner lives. And some dogs are being studied a lot now. They're a great subject because they've lived with us and manipulated us for 15,000 years or so, and so they're good to work with. A recent study shows fairness awareness in dogs, where if two dogs are offered a hand to shake, and these are dogs who've learned that trick of offering a paw to shake a hand, they happily do that 30 times or more. But the minute you introduce treats, it gets Machiavellian, and if one dog's receiving treats and the other one isn't, the other dog will soon stop offering the paw and will turn away. Apparently objecting to the imbalance of treatment. It's been shown in monkeys as well. They have this inequity aversion or fairness awareness. So the roots of morality lie well beyond humans. Play behavior requires restraint, and animals are often behaving good to each other. They help raise young of others and this sort of thing. And I discussed that at some length in Second Nature. And it's just another facet of animal lives that we've only recently been tuning into. So virtue is an exciting new frontier in the study of animal behavior.
How do you respond to people that say that the ideas you're pushing forward are just junk science?
I must say, people haven't put it that way to me. You're the first one, Mike. I object
okay.
to that. No, I know you don't feel that way. I've never heard anyone, people take this stuff seriously. They're really interested, and I'm encouraged by that because, you know, speaking of virtue, we have a long way to go in virtue towards other animals. I'm encouraged by our ability to rise above past wrongs. You know, we used to have a slave trade. Colonialism has largely gone by the by, and women now have the right to vote around the world, and the civil rights movement has had huge success, of course. So we can rise above our old might makes right ways of thinking, but our relationship to animals is still a might makes right one. I mentioned how many we kill earlier. We cage them, we torture them, we do things to them that we would never accept doing to our fellow human. And so that's sort of the deeper message of my book and my writings on animals more broadly, is to get people to reflect on that relationship. And really where the rubber meets the road, Mike, on this issue is meat. It's food. It's people eating animals. If people continue to eat animals, then, there's only so much we can do to advocate for animals and to prevent suffering if we advocate for them between bites of a cheeseburger. The meat industry and the dairy industry are the industries that cause far and away the most suffering and harm to animals worldwide.
And briefly, we only have about a minute left. So do you see it as a legitimate step in moving from the large agro-industrial production of animals towards, let's say, a small, you know, farmer organic run operations?
Yeah, the planet cannot sustain 6.5 billion people eating a meat-centered diet, and that's kind of unfortunately the direction we're moving in right now. Vegetarianism is catching on here in the West, but the parts of Asia, particularly China and India, they're rushing to catch up to Western lifestyles, and that's unfortunately turning us in the wrong direction. Certainly family farms, smaller farms would be a big step in the right direction, but I certainly encourage people to be vegetarian or vegan. I've been vegan for over 20 years, and it's obviously healthier. Well, it's not only is it healthy and good for the environment, but first and foremost, it's a much more humane relationship to animals. So I hope we'll look back on the 21st century as the century for animals, because that is the next great social movement. We need to change this very troubled, exploitative relationship we have to them.
All right. In addition to your book, Second Nature, The Inner Lives of Animals, do you have a website people can turn to?
I do. It's www and then my name. So it's jonathanbalcom.com.
All right. Well, with that, we are unfortunately out of time. I want to thank you very much for coming and spending time with us this morning.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
Again, we've just been talking with Jonathan Balcom, author of Second Nature, The Inner Lives of Animals. And you can also find out more via his website, JonathanBalcom.com.